The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power by Robert A. Caro, Part 3, Continued. He had managed to break out of the trap of the hill country. He might not be able to escape the trap of the seniority system before he died. And then in 1939, Sam Ely Johnson's younger brother, George Desha Johnson, Lyndon's schoolteacher uncle who had gotten him a job at Sam Houston High, and with whom Lyndon had boarded while he was teaching there, suffered a massive heart attack. He died a few months later, at the age of 57. While the seniority system might deny a junior congressman the opportunity to play a significant role in the committee structure of the House of Representatives, his very membership in the House provided him with an opportunity to play a different type of role. Unable to contribute significantly to legislation, he nonetheless possessed the power to bring an issue to the attention of the nation, and to keep that issue before the nation. Muffled within the institutional structure of Capitol Hill, his voice would be magnified if he chose to address himself to the nation instead of the House. When he spoke in the well of the House, the reporters sitting above him in the press gallery were a sounding board through which his views could reach an entire nation. A congressman didn't even need the well. The very corridors of Congress, where reporters take down a congressman's comment on a major development, could be a sounding board. Even a mimeograph machine could be a national megaphone, if the machine was in a congressman's office. Any House member can make the news simply by getting a press handout to the press gallery early in the morning, Richard Bolling was to say. When a major subject is on top of the news and the wire services are hurrying to assemble a reaction story, any provocative comment from a member of Congress is likely to get scooped up and given a sentence or two. All a congressman had to do was speak, and he would be your spokesman. Proof of this fact was readily available to Lyndon Johnson in the careers of three congressmen with whom he was particularly well acquainted. Proof from the past, for one junior congressman who had declined to stay silent, who had refused to be relegated to that lock-jawed ostracism because he was the voice of 200,000 persons who needed a voice that would be heard, had been Sam Rayburn. And proof from the present, in the persons of Wright Patman, his father's friend, who had risen to influence in the House on stands that his father would have applauded, and of Maury Maverick, whose district adjoined Johnson's. 1937, the year Johnson came to Congress, was the year of peak influence of Maury and his Mavericks, 35 young congressmen who met every week in Renkel's cafeteria to discuss strategies for confounding the House's conservative leadership and advancing causes which, as the Washington Post commented, would have been labeled Bryan-esque 25 years ago. Maverick himself had become a national rallying point for such causes. Congressmen such as Rayburn and Patman and Maverick, and during the 30s other congressmen such as Tom Amley of Wisconsin and Fiorella LaGuardia of New York, had become representatives not just of a district but of causes that affected the welfare of a nation. They had focused America's attention upon significant issues that prepared the climate for the passage, if not immediately, then eventually, of significant legislation. Had become, by introducing what was, in effect, national legislation, national legislators. This course carried with it rewards for a congressman who cared about such causes. Such a course was not invariably quixotic, even in terms of immediate results. Anyone who thought a young congressman's cause was lost before it began to live had only to remember that Sam Rayburn had become the railroad legislator with significant bills to his credit by the end of his second term in Congress. Johnson, moreover, had had an opportunity to see this with his own eyes during his years as a congressional secretary. For those years had been the years of Fiorella LaGuardia, tiny, swarthy, black sombreroed, tough enough to face down Garner in the chair and make him like it. LaGuardia, who fought the interests on behalf of the rural as well as the urban poor. Fight, farmers, fight. Fight for your homes and your children. Your names will live with Paul Revere. And who had, in 1932, succeeded in having outlawed, in the Norris-LaGuardia Act, the hated Yellow Dog Contract. Liberal and radical stands might eventually destroy a Maverick whose San Antonio constituency, largely military men and Catholics, was conservative. But Lyndon Johnson could have taken such stands with no such fear, for in his district, that stronghold of the People's Party, the New Deal's popularity never waned. Johnson might, in fact, have been expected to take such stands. His victory, after all, had been based on such stands. He had shouted, "Roosevelt, Roosevelt, Roosevelt," and promised to support future as well as present New Deal proposals. Taking stands was not, however, a course which Johnson adopted. He did not take one, in fact, even on the issue on which he had based his campaign. After Johnson took his oath as congressman on May 13th, Maverick had shouted, "Mr. Speaker, the gentleman just sworn in, Mr. Lyndon Johnson, supported the president's judiciary plan and was overwhelmingly elected." Johnson himself said nothing about the president's plan at the time, or, so far as can be determined, at any other time while in Washington. By May 13th, Supreme Court packing had been effectively doomed by congressional opposition. But the fight on the plan was far from over. The Senate Judiciary Committee's crucial 10-8 vote against it would not come until May 18th, and maneuvering over the terms of a compromise measure would continue for another 2 months. But Johnson, who had asked his district to send him to Washington to show support of the president's plan, offered not a single public word of support himself. As for other causes, Johnson's overall record on the introduction of national legislation, legislation which would have an effect outside his own district, was equally striking. Lyndon Johnson became a congressman in 1937. He did not introduce a national bill in 1937, or in 1938, 1939, or 1940. When he introduced one in 1941, on December 9th, 2 days after Pearl Harbor, it was a bill to create a job for himself by merging the National Youth Administration and the Civilian Conservation Corps into a single agency which would train youths for war work in factories, and to whose chairmanship he hoped President Roosevelt would appoint him because of his NYA experience. Since he did not introduce a national bill in 1942, that single bill, an attempt to increase his personal power, was the only piece of national legislation he proposed during his first 6 years in Congress. Was this a function of inexperience? He was hardly more active in this regard at the end of his House career than at the beginning. He introduced one national bill in 1943 and two in 1945, but none in 1946, none in 1947, and only one in 1948. During his more than 11 years in the House of Representatives, he introduced only 5 bills that could affect the country as a whole. As striking as the paucity of such bills was their sponsors' effort on their behalf. With a single exception, there was no effort. During his 11 years in the House, only once did Lyndon Johnson appear in support of a national bill he had introduced before the committee to which it had been referred. And with that one exception, no national bill he introduced received serious, or indeed even pro forma, consideration from any House committee. Of the 5 pieces of legislation of interest to more than his own district, which, in 11 years, he placed in the House hopper, 4 were pieces of paper introduced pro forma, without genuine interest and enthusiasm from their sponsor. The one fight he made for a 1943 bill aimed at curbing absenteeism in war plants by requiring the drafting of any worker absent too often ended in fiasco. He apparently introduced it in his own Naval Affairs Committee without the courtesy of consulting with the chairman of the committee that had jurisdiction over such measures, the House Labor Committee. The Naval Affairs Committee reported the measure out favorably, but the angry chairman of the Labor Committee asked the Rules Committee, which controls the flow of legislation to the floor, not to let this bill reach the floor. An embarrassed Carl Vinson had to admit that he had assumed, incorrectly, that the Labor Committee had surrendered jurisdiction, and the bill died in the Rules Committee. During his 11 years as a congressman, therefore, no national bill introduced by Lyndon Johnson that would have affected the people of the United States became law of the United States. He didn't introduce legislation himself, and he wouldn't fight for legislation introduced by others. He wouldn't fight publicly. He didn't write laws, and he didn't write speeches, at least not speeches to be delivered in Washington. The speeches that the brilliant Henderson kept turning out were delivered only on Johnson's trips home to the district. This was a dramatic departure from the usual practice among congressmen, who were allowed merely to insert their speeches into the congressional record without bothering to read them on the floor of the House. All that was required, under the House rule allowing members virtually unlimited freedom to revise and extend their remarks in the record, was that a member read the opening words of a speech and hand it to a clerk for reprinting in the record. Because anything printed in the record can be reprinted at government expense, and then mailed at government expense under the franking privilege, congressmen used the right to revise and extend, to have tens of thousands of copies of their statements reprinted and mailed to their constituents, thereby gaining free publicity and creating the impression of deep involvement in national issues. The record was crammed with speeches never spoken on the floor. But although Johnson made maximum use of other avenues of publicity, very few of the remarks extended were extended by him. Entire years went by in which he did not use the device even once. He did not use it in 1940, 42, 44, 45, or 47. Until 1948, when, after 11 years in Congress, his practice dramatically changed because he was running for United States Senator, he had used this device just 14 times, a number like the number of bills he introduced, far below the congressional average. His record in regard to real speeches, talks of more than a paragraph or two in length that were actually delivered in the House, was even more striking. On August 8, 1941, after weeks of prodding by Sam Rayburn, who felt it was time, and more than time, for Johnson to raise his voice in the House, Johnson stepped into the well of the House to advocate the extension of the Selective Service Act. The date was noteworthy. He had been a congressman for 4 years, with the exception of a brief memorial tribute to Albert Sidney Burleson when Burleson died in November 1937. This was the first speech he had made. He didn't make another one for 18 months. Rising then to argue for his absenteeism bill, he would say, "Mr. Speaker, in the 4 terms that I have served in this House, I have seldom asked your indulgence." After the absenteeism fight, he didn't make another speech for almost another 3 years. Entire years went by without Lyndon Johnson addressing the House even once, 1938, 39, 1940, 42, and 44. In fact, until 1948, when the necessities of his campaign for the United States Senate changed his methods, he had, during 11 years in Congress, delivered a total of 10 speeches, less than one a year. He wouldn't fight in the well of the House, and he wouldn't fight on the floor. His demeanor during debates, during the give-and-take argumentation about legislation, was noteworthy. Imitating it, his colleague Helen Gehagan Douglas of California depicts a person sitting slouched far down in a chair, his head in one hand. "He looked the picture of boredom, slumped in his chair with his eyes half closed," she says, "and he seldom stayed long. He never spoke in the House, you know, except on rare, rare occasions." And, Mrs. Douglas adds, "he didn't spend much time listening to others in the House. He might sit for a while, the picture of boredom, and then suddenly he jumped to his feet, nervous, restless, as if he couldn't bear it another minute. He might stop to speak to some member on the floor of the House or to the Speaker, then he'd leave. As he departed, loping off the floor with that great stride of his as though he was on some Texas plain," she says, "he always gave the impression of someone in a hurry." The Mavericks did a lot of fighting on the floor. When Johnson arrived in Washington, they expected him to enroll in their ranks, a not unnatural expectation, since they had read about this man who had shouted "Roosevelt, Roosevelt, Roosevelt," and had won by supporting the president on the Supreme Court packing issue. Roosevelt was their hero, and the president's causes their causes, and Maverick had assured them that this young man, whom he said he knew well, held the same views as they. In fact, Johnson enrolled for a time. For several weeks he attended the dinners at Renkel's. But then he stopped attending, and the Mavericks found that if he held their views he would not argue for them. Not that he would argue against them, says one of them, Edward V. M. Isaac of California. "He just simply was not especially interested in general legislation that came to the floor of the House. Some of us were on the floor all the time, fighting for liberal causes. But he stayed away from the floor, and while he was there he was very, very silent." And Isaac's evaluation, which is echoed by others among Johnson's colleagues, is documented quite dramatically by the record of Johnson's participation in House discussion and debates. The record is almost non-existent. Whole years went by in which Johnson did not rise even once to make a point of order, or any other point, not to ask or answer a question, not to support or attack a bill under discussion, not to participate by so much as a single word in an entire year's worth of floor proceedings in the House. His attitude toward comments that would be made public through the press was equally notable. He was not one of the congressmen who sought out reporters to comment on some national issue. On the contrary, he would go to unusual lengths to avoid having to reveal his opinion. A reporter would be standing in a corridor, soliciting comments from passing congressmen. Johnson would start to turn into that corridor, see the reporter, whirl on his heel, and hastily walk back the way he had come. If he didn't fight in public, would he fight in private? Some of the most effective congressmen, while rather silent in the well of the House or on the floor, although the congressional record indicates that few were as silent as Johnson, are active in the aisle at the rear of the House chamber, or in its cloakrooms. Standing in that aisle, one foot up on the brass rail that separates the aisle from the members' seats, these brass railers quietly buttonhole fellow members to argue for or against legislation. Lyndon Johnson was not one of these congressmen. Not that he was silent in the rear aisle or in the cloakrooms. He was friendly, gregarious, could, his fellow members agree, even be said to talk a lot. But he didn't say anything. Congressmen now observed what classmates had once observed, that while he might be speaking very volubly during a conversation on a controversial issue, he wouldn't take a position on the issue, or indeed say anything of a substantive nature. He tried to avoid specifics, and, if pinned down, would say what the other person wanted to hear. He did it very well, as discussions with his congressional colleagues revealed. If the congressman was a liberal, he believes that Lyndon Johnson as a congressman was a liberal. Says the staunchly liberal Mrs. Douglas, "We agreed on so many of the big issues, he basically agreed with the liberals." But if the congressman was a conservative, he says that Lyndon Johnson as a congressman was a conservative. Says the reactionary upstate New York Republican Sterling Cole, "Politically, if we disagreed, it wasn't apparent to me, not at all." Great issues came before the House in these years. 1938, for example, was the year in which it was embroiled in bitter battles over President Roosevelt's proposal to reorganize the executive branch and create new cabinet departments to facilitate the meeting of new social needs. The Dictator Bill, angry congressmen called it. 1938 was also the year of the great battle over the Wages and Hours Bill, the proposal to free American workers from the bondage of the early industrial age. It was the year of the battle over the proposal to extend and make more meaningful Social Security benefits. And most significantly of all, 1938, the year in which the New Deal had to face its own recession, was the year of the great debate in Washington over whether to fight that recession with mammoth new spending programs, or whether a balanced budget, the balanced budget which the president himself so devoutly wished for, was more important. An issue whose resolution was to affect the fundamentals of American life for years, if not decades, to come. Lyndon Johnson did not participate, neither with legislation nor with debate, not on the well of the House, or on the floor, or in its cloakrooms or committees, in these battles. He had shouted, "Roosevelt, Roosevelt, Roosevelt," to get to Congress. In Congress he shouted nothing, said nothing, stood for nothing. Not only was he not in the van of any cause, he was not in the ranks, either. Lyndon Johnson would later be called a legislative genius. A legislator is a maker of laws. During the 11 years that Lyndon Johnson served in the lawmaking body that is the House of Representatives, few of its 435 members had less to do with the making of its laws than he. Some of the more astute of his colleagues felt that they understood the reason for his silence. Mrs. Douglas, who spent a lot of time with him, speculates on his reasons for acting this way. One that she suggests is caution. Was it just caution? Just that he didn't want to have a lot of his words come back at him? A more cautious way of working in the Congress than that of many others. He was witty, he would tell stories, he was humorous, but he was always aware of being responsible for what he said. He was always aware that what he said might be repeated or remembered, even years later. And he didn't want someone to come back years later and say, "I remember when you said..." Watching him talk so much and say so little, Mrs. Douglas began to realize, she says, that Lyndon Johnson was strong. In Washington, she says, everyone tried to find out where you stood, but he had great inner control. He could talk so much, and no one ever knew exactly where he stood. Even years later. By keeping silent, Johnson might, of course, simply be following a proven path to power in the House of Representatives. It was the path that Rayburn had taken, and Rayburn was in power now. But they were not on the same path. Power in the House was the power Rayburn wanted. The lone chair atop the triple dais was the goal that iron-willed man had set for himself as a boy in a barn. That was his only goal. He had been asked once to run for the Senate, all but assured of success. He had refused to make the race. Although the immense power he wielded as majority leader and, after September 1940, as Speaker, would have allowed him, had he wished to do so, to wield considerable statewide power in Texas, he declined every opportunity to do so. The only interest he ever displayed in the NYA was to obtain Lyndon Johnson's appointment as its head. The only interest he ever displayed in the PWA was to have it build a dam, the Denison Dam, in his own district. He displayed no interest at all in other statewide organizations the New Deal was creating in Texas. The WPA, for example, or the Rural Electrification Administration. Most of the big businessmen who wielded so much statewide power in Texas couldn't even get an appointment with him on their trips to Washington. Only the House itself mattered. But power in the House was not the power at which Johnson was aiming. The triple dais was not high enough for him. The difference between the aims of the older man and the younger had been demonstrated even before Johnson became a congressman, when, as Clayburgh's secretary, he had placed himself at the service of businessmen who were not from Clayburgh's district. Had not practically his first move as congressman, made while he was still in his hospital bed, been to keep the statewide NYA under his control? And now, were not the letters from his office going out, not just to addresses in his district, but to addresses in Houston and Dallas and El Paso as well? A House seat had been an indispensable staging area on the long road he saw before him. He had no choice but to come back a congressman. But the House seat was only a staging area. It was not the destination at the end of that long road. He had needed the seat. He didn't want to stay in it long. So his silence was not for the sake of power in the House. If he was keeping deliberately silent, it was for a different reason. Who could foresee the turnings of so long a road? No matter how safe a particular stand might seem now, no matter how politically wise, that stand might come back to haunt him some day. No matter what he said now, no matter how intelligent a remark might now seem, he might one day be sorry he had made it. And so he said nothing. His standing on Capitol Hill, outside the Texas delegation, was, moreover, not improving. For a while he was very popular with his fellow congressmen, for the same reasons he was popular with the young New Dealers. Not only because of his charm, his storytelling ability, his desire to ingratiate, and his skill in doing so, but because, in George Brown's words, he was a leader of men. Johnson had the knack of always appealing to a fellow about someone he didn't like. If he was talking to Joe and Joe didn't like Jim, he'd say he didn't like Jim too. That was his leadership, that was his knack. And of course, for a while, congressional liberals thought he was one of them, while congressional conservatives thought he was one of them. But some of them began to catch on. Liberals found it was useless to ask him to speak in support of a bill in which they were interested. Conservatives found it impossible to persuade him to speak in support of their legislation. The judgment implied in Isaac's statement that Johnson was very, very silent on the floor came to be a widespread judgment among Johnson's colleagues. Pragmatism was, of course, not unknown on Capitol Hill. For many congressmen, it was a way of life. Caution was only common sense. But in the opinion of more and more of his fellows, Lyndon Johnson's pragmatism and caution went beyond the norm. Colleagues committed to causes began to regard him with something akin to scorn. And then, of course, there was the aspect of his personality that had been so noticeable since his boyhood on the vacant lots of Johnson City, where if he couldn't pitch, he would take his ball and go home. The quality which led one Johnson City companion to say, if he couldn't lead, he didn't care much about playing. That aspect had been noticeable in Washington, too. He couldn't stand not being somebody, just could not stand it, Estelle Harbin had said. Lyndon Johnson could not endure being only one of a crowd. He needed, with a compelling need, to lead, and not merely to lead, but to dominate, to bend others to his will. At cocktail parties, he could hold the stage when the other guests were young New Dealers, and even for a time, by the force of his personality, when the guests included older men with more power. But in power-obsessed Washington, when older, more powerful men were present, he couldn't hold the stage for long. And on Capitol Hill, where the pecking order was so clearly and firmly established, and he was near the bottom, he was able to hold attention much less. His stories, vivid though they were, commanded much less attention in a congressional cloakroom than in a Georgetown living room. He wanted to give advice, It was good advice. He had a rare talent not only for politics but for organization, and congressmen were continually searching for ways to improve the organization of their offices, a skill of which he was the master. But few of his colleagues wanted advice from a junior colleague. He wanted to give lectures, pontificating in the cloakroom or back of the rail as he had pontificated in the Dodge Hotel basement. But his fellow congressmen resented his dogmatic, overbearing tone at least as strongly as his fellow congressional secretaries had resented it. His skills at manipulating men were useless without at least a modicum of power to back them up, and he possessed no power at all. Says James Van Zandt of Pennsylvania, "When he wanted something, he really went after it. He would say, 'Now, God damn it, Jimmy, I helped you on this. I want you to help me on this.'" And Van Zandt adds, "Johnson kept asking for favors, and he simply didn't have that many to give in return." He tried too hard, much too hard, to trade on what minor help he had given. "You can do those things once or twice," Van Zandt says. "He did them too frequently. People would get irritated." The pattern which had emerged in the Little Congress, and before that at San Marcos, was repeated in the Big Congress. The older men to whom he was so deferential were fond of Lyndon Johnson. Among his contemporaries, those whom he needed and to whom he was also deferential, Roe and Corcoran, for example, were also fond of him. Another few, very few, of his contemporaries in Congress were fond of him, most of them unassertive men such as Pogue and Van Zandt. But the feeling of others was quite different. Says O.C. Fisher, whose Texas district adjoined Johnson's 10th, "He had a way of getting along with the leaders, and he didn't bother much with the small fry. And let me tell you, the small fry didn't mind. They didn't want too much to do with him, either." Even Van Zandt, one of his admirers, says, "People were critical of him because he was too ambitious, too forceful, too pushy. Some people didn't like him." As he walked through the House dining room, the resentment that followed him did not come only from members of the Texas delegation. Says Lucas, "Guys from other states would come in and sit down at a table near where Johnson was sitting. They would greet all their fellow members nearby, except him. And he would get up and say, 'Well, Joe, why in the hell didn't you speak to me?' Well, they hadn't spoken to him because they didn't like him. They wouldn't put up with him." The situation was summed up in a symbolic gesture, a shrinking away. Lyndon Johnson still practiced his habit of grasping a man's lapel with one hand and putting his other arm around the man's shoulders, holding him close while staring into his eyes and talking directly into his face. Some of his fellow congressmen didn't mind him doing this, even liked having him do it, recalls Van Zandt. "He would put his hand on my shoulder and say, 'Now look, Jimmy, I liked him a lot. You always felt relaxed in his presence.'" But others, many others, did mind. They would draw back from his hand, shrug away from his arm. And sometimes, if he didn't take the hint, they would get angry. Once he took a congressman's lapel in his hand, and the congressman knocked his hand away. Without power to back it up, his manner of dealing with his colleagues earned him not the power he craved, but only unpopularity. His role on the Naval Affairs Committee could hardly have added to his enjoyment of life in Congress. He and Warren Magnuson, a dashing bachelor who sat in the next chair in the committee's lower horseshoe, had, according to one of Carl Vinson's aides, discovered how to play up to the chairman by telling him stories, stories with a sexual tinge. Humorous, dirty jokes and the details of amorous escapades, which he enjoyed with real vicarious pleasure. Devoted to his invalid wife, Vincent, Magnuson says, went home early each afternoon to take care of his wife, and he never invited anyone to visit him. He was a recluse. But the two young congressmen began dropping in on him, telling him their stories, and, Magnuson says, before long we were in solidly with the admiral. Fond though he may have been of them, however, they were still only ensigns on a very tight ship, as Johnson was constantly and painfully being reminded. Occasionally, during the questioning of a witness, he would essay a small witticism. "Is the gentleman from Texas finished?" Vinson would demand dryly. The gavel would crash down. "Let's proceed," the chairman would say. Johnson had become fascinated with tape recorders, which were, in 1939 and 1940, large, clumsy devices just beginning to come into public use. One morning he brought a tape recorder into the committee room before the hearing began, and set it up at his seat, running the wire over to a microphone which he placed on the witness table. Vinson arrived, slouched down in his seat, lit up a cigar, and then, just as he was about to gavel the hearing to order, noticed the recorder. Peering over the glasses teetering on the end of his nose, he said, "Now, what does the gentleman from Texas have there?"
"A tape recorder, Mr. Chairman," Johnson replied. "We have a witness from Texas this morning. I'd like to record his statement and send it to the radio stations down in Texas."
"Well," Vincent said, "the gentleman is not going to do that. We are not going to record witnesses, and we are not going to send statements back to the district."
He curtly ordered Johnson to remove the recorder from the room. To Johnson's humiliation, he had to do so before the eyes of the visitor from Texas. When Johnson had been sworn in 1937, only two congressmen had been younger than he. Now, in 1939, there were quite a few younger. He was no longer even the youngest congressman from Texas. Newspaper articles on the state's congressional contingent often mentioned the baby of the delegation. They were referring to Lindley Beckworth of Gladewater, near Marshall, who had been elected in 1938 at the age of 25. Although Johnson would not be 31 until August 1939, he was no longer a particularly youthful congressman. He was only a junior congressman, one of several hundred junior congressmen, one of a crowd. At the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, too, he seemed to be retreating rather than advancing. Unable to see President Roosevelt in person, he attempted on March 24, 1939, to catch his attention and elicit a response with a rather unusual letter. It was ostensibly a recommendation of an acquaintance for a federal post, but it began, "Sir, sometimes as I go about my work for the 10th District of Texas and the United States as a whole, thoughts come into my mind I feel I just have to talk over with the chief. I know I can't consume your time with them in appointments, but I am persuaded to do what I am doing now, get out my paper and typewriter and drop you a note." If Johnson had hoped to thus elicit a response from the chief, however, he was to be disappointed. The response came instead from Presidential Secretary Stephen Early, and it was distinctly pro forma. "You may be sure that your comments will be given careful consideration," it said. In the event, Johnson's candidate did not get the post. During that same month, Johnson wrote Roosevelt requesting increased funding for the Texas A&M ROTC unit. The White House referred the request to the War Department, which cursorily rejected it. There was, White House aides agree, no particular reason for Johnson's complete lack of success in making contact with the man in the Oval Office. There was, they say, no reason that he should have made contact. "You've got to have a reason to see a president," Roe explains. Johnson had no reason. And Roe, and other New Dealers who knew of Johnson's unsuccessful efforts, could see no hope that he would have a reason, not at least in any immediate future. He was, after all, only a junior congressman from one of the most remote and isolated regions in the United States. Those of them who, like Roe, guessed his ambitions, could see no way that he would get to be a senator, much less a national power, not in the foreseeable future, at least. How could he possibly transform a political base that consisted of an isolated district in a remote region of far-off Texas into a national base? How could he possibly, in any foreseeable future, be anything more than an obscure congressman? Lyndon Johnson could not endure being only one of a crowd, but as the spring of 1939 turned into summer, one of a crowd was all he was, and for long years to come, it seemed, that was all he was likely to be. Chapter 30. A Contract and Three Telegrams. During the summer of 1939, however, he took a desperate step. This maneuver involved Sam Rayburn. Its backdrop was one of the great dramas of American political history, the blood feud between the President of the United States and the Vice President. This feud had been raging since shortly after the two men had run together for the second time, teammates in one of the greatest election triumphs in American history. Even before the 1936 election, John Nance Garner, perturbed over the direction the New Deal was taking, had been protesting to Franklin Roosevelt. Garner had felt the emergency measures of the 100 days were necessary. He felt that the president had saved the country. But by 1934, he felt the emergency was over. The measures should be phased out. As early as October 1934, in a blunt letter to Roosevelt from Uvalde, he advised him to cut down as far as possible the cost of government. "Pardon me for mentioning this matter because it is not my butt in, but it does pertain to the expenditure of federal funds which goes with living within your income and paying something on your debts. The still more liberal measures of 1935's second 100 days, measures such as Social Security, the Wagner Labor Relations Act, and above all inheritance and stepped-up income taxes, were the very antithesis of the simple rugged frontier philosophy in which Cactus Jack Garner believed with all his heart. The continued heavy governmental expenditures and annual budget deficits of the New Deal, how Cactus Jack hated that phrase, must inevitably lead, he believed, to another depression. 30 years later, in 1965, when Garner was 96, a Washington journalist would travel to Uvalde to ask him if he had any advice for government. "Stop the spending," the old man growled. His protests had been strictly private. If individualism was one pillar of Garner's philosophy, loyalty was another, loyalty to party and loyalty to his leader. The politician he loathed above all others was Maury Maverick, who stood for everything he detested, and who had, moreover, beaten his friends, the old city machine, in San Antonio. But when Maverick ran for re-election in 1936 against the city machine, Garner arranged for the financing of Maverick's campaign, because Roosevelt had asked him to do so. Sometimes his feelings about the New Deal showed in personal letters to Texas. When in 1936 an old friend, the wealthy Houston lumberman John Henry Kirby, who was the chairman of the ultra-conservative Southern Committee to uphold the Constitution, demanded, "How long are you going to tolerate the apostasy of the Roosevelt administration?" Garner replied tersely, "You can't do everything you want to, and I can't do half what I would like to do. You don't control everybody you would like to, and I am in a similar fix. I think that answers your question." But his feelings had, before the 1936 election, never showed in Washington. Disagree with administration proposals though he might, he lobbied for them with the conservatives who had been his friends during his 30 years on Capitol Hill. No man was more influential in the Senate than Garner. Joseph Alsop and Turner Catledge wrote in their detailed and invaluable book on the court fight, The 168 Days. In the president's first administration, larger numbers of senators had seen the light on New Deal measures in Garner's private office with the well-stocked liquor closet than anywhere else in Washington. Then, at the end of 1936, just weeks after the election, came the sit-down strikes. Garner's sizable fortune, as well as that of his Texas friends and of his Southern friends in Congress, had been built on cheap labor. In Uvalde, located as it was beyond the 98th meridian, little cotton was grown. Instead, Garner grew pecans. Pecans were picked by the Mexican-Americans who made up more than half of Uvalde's population. The work was hard. After the pecans were knocked out of the trees, they had to be shelled, a job which required strong hands. And for it, Garner paid 1 cent per pound. A good man could, his fingers bleeding from 100 small cuts, pick as many as 100 pounds in a day, $1 for a day's work. Mexicans were satisfied with that wage, Garner would explain. They are not troublesome people unless they become Americanized. The sheriff can make them do anything. Not that white labor earned much more in Uvalde. Garner built and rented out homes. The union scale for carpenters in Texas was 1 1/4 an hour. Garner paid his carpenters the quarter, although there were a few who worked their way up to 50 cents an hour, until they made a mistake. "Like sawing a board a mite too short," an Uvalde carpenter explained. "Why, back you go first thing to 25 cents. Just one mistake, that's all." To men accustomed to treating laborers like serfs, the very idea of unions was anathema. There were none in Uvalde. "Mr. Garner, he don't like unions," another carpenter explained. "The plumbers, they had a union once, but they don't now." And sit-down strikes were the ultimate outrage, for this form of labor strife, in which workers seized possession of their employer's plant and stayed there, sitting down at their jobs, threatened the sacred right of private property. At a cabinet meeting, Garner said, as he was to recall it, "They permitted men to take over other people's property. In Texas, we would call that stealing. That's when I said the federal government owed it to the country to protect the property. I got ugly about it and cussed and raised Cain." He also went to see Roosevelt personally. As he related the discussion to his lifelong friend and authorized biographer, journalist Bascom Timmons, "I asked the president, 'Do you think it is right?' 'No,' he replied. 'Do you think it is legal?' 'No,' he replied." Garner left this meeting under the impression that Roosevelt had promised to immediately issue a statement denouncing the new labor tactic, and, if the situation worsened, to take stronger action. But neither statement nor action materialized. This was not the first time that Garner felt Roosevelt had broken his word. He believed the president had repeatedly promised him to balance the budget. John Gunther was to write about Roosevelt's worst quality, a deviousness, a lack of candor that verged on deceit. Men who had known Roosevelt longer, when he had been governor of New York, used stronger words. In Albany, it had been whispered that a commitment from the governor could not be trusted. New York City's ordinarily mild-mannered legislative representative, Reuben Lazarus, told him to his face, "Governor, from now on, we deal in writing, and I'm going to demand a bond on your signature." His state park commissioner, Robert Moses, not mild-mannered, shouted at him one day, "Frank Roosevelt, you're a goddamned liar, and this time I can prove it. I had a stenographer present." Garner told a friend that the president was a charming fellow, but he was a hard man to have an understanding with. He would deviate from the understanding. To a man like Garner, no judgment could have been harsher. In the world of Capitol Hill, where a congressional session was round after round of hastily formed alliances, trust in a man's word was all important. Garner himself was known for honoring his promises, however inconvenient they later proved. In 1937, sit-down strikes were widening, and no presidential action was forthcoming. Ossoff and Catledge wrote that Garner, feeling he had been fooled by the president all through the business, flew into a fury. Garner, in a fury, was a man who lost control of his tongue. At a conference with Roosevelt, a conference at which Majority Leader Joseph T. Robinson was present, Garner was to say that, "We went at it hot and heavy," so hot and heavy that, Ossoff and Catledge reported, before very long both men had forgotten their self-control and were using such language to one another that Joe Robinson, horrified, shouted them down and forced them to end the conference. And then, on February 5, 1937, Roosevelt introduced his court-packing bill. Neither Garner nor any congressional leader had been given so much as a hint that such a measure was being prepared. Summoned to the White House, they were informed half an hour before Roosevelt announced it to the press. Garner was to say, moreover, that Roosevelt had assured him and Robinson not 3 weeks before that there would be little other than appropriations bills for Congress to consider. During his first term, the president had been generally scrupulous in consulting with Capitol Hill. Had his second election led him to feel that he no longer needed to consult, that, as Ossoff and Catledge put it, compliance with his wishes? His overconfidence blinded him, Ossoff and Catledge were to conclude. This book is continued on cassette number 2, side 1.